Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I am talking with author Penny Musco. She's explored and written about many of the national park units, and you're going to see why I mentioned that, because the name of her book is Life Lessons from the National Parks, Meeting God in America's Most Glorious Places. Penny, welcome to Life Quest.
Thank you for having me.
Penny, before we get into specifically your book, could you tell our listeners a bit, how did you get into this interest in America's national parks?
Well, we've always been, as a family, going to national parks. When my daughter was growing up, we always loved national parks. And the book started as a blog, actually, when mm-hmm. we were visiting the Everglades in Florida in 2009, because I saw something there and I said, this is a lot like life. It was a bald cypress tree, and it looked dead. And I thought, sometimes I feel dead, but I'm really alive. And I thought, this is a life lesson from the national park.
Right.
And so we've always been visiting. And it was just in 2009 where I got the first idea for the book.
Well, you know, I looked at it, there are a lot of different national parks, which I suppose I didn't really know about at all. You know, we've heard about things like Carlsbad Canyons and Yosemite and Yellowstone and all that sort of thing. But there's a lot more, aren't there?
Yes. As of today, there are 412 units of the national park, and some of them are parks, the biggies. 59 of them, like Yellowstone and Yosemite,
mm-hmm.
but the majority are all different ones. They're historic sites like Thomas Edison's laboratory, they're national monuments,
mm-hmm.
And there's seashores like Cape Hatteras, and there's lakeshores like around the Great Lakes. So there's everything, every kind of thing you could want in the national parks.
Now, if I remember my history well, and I should because I've taught it, but that is, I believe Theodore Roosevelt had some tremendous interest in preserving parts of our country. And
yes, he did. Theodore Roosevelt was instrumental in starting many of the national parks because he was an outdoor enthusiast.
Mm-hmm.
And the man that got him interested is the man that we consider the father of the National Park Service, who is John Muir.
Yes. Well, that's fantastic. What I thought we would do, Penny, if that's all right, is just you've divided it up by the seasons, really, haven't you, your book?
Yes.
And mm-hmm. Why don't we take a couple from each one as time permits. I was looking at this national park that has to do with Ford's Theater, of all things. President Lincoln, where he was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. And you use at the beginning of the chapter a text from the book of Genesis, chapter 50, verses 19 through 20. Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done." Tell us about the park and how that connects with this Bible text.
You picked one of my favorite stories. The story of Dr. Samuel Mudd,
mm-hmm.
who is the doctor who set Booth's leg. If you remember, John Booth, he jumped off the stage and he broke his leg, and then he fled through the Maryland countryside. And Dr. Mudd was an acquaintance of his, so he set his leg, and then later he was found guilty of aiding Booth, and he was sentenced to Dry Tortugas National Park, which is off the coast of Key West, about 70 miles in the Gulf of Mexico.
Really?
And that's where he was imprisoned.
Hmm.
And the staff physician died during a yellow fever outbreak, and so Mudd took over his job. And the soldiers who were guarding that fort at, it was a military prison at Dry Tortugas, Fort Jefferson, were so grateful that they petitioned President Andrew Johnson to pardon Mudd because they said he did so much, and he did.
Oh, he did.
President Johnson did pardon him. And, you know, Mudd, most historians now think that Mudd wasn't really part of the conspiracy, but he was guilty of not alerting them that he saw Booth. So bad things happen to us, sometimes through our own stupidity. Sometimes we have no control over things that happen.
Yes.
But God assures us in His Word that He uses it for good, to bring about His purposes. And that's a tremendously hopeful story that
really
we find right there in the national parks.
That's fantastic. I remember it was a newscaster, Roger Mudd, who was a relative, and he did his best to also clarify his ancestor and his name.
Yes.
Now, let's go next to... You've titled this chapter, God Still Speaks, Thomas Edison National Historical Park. And you have a text from Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets of many times and in various ways. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son. So tell us about Thomas Edison National Historical Park.
It is a really cool place. It is his laboratory, and it's also the first movie theater in the United States. Thomas Edison invented the phonograph, but he also had something to do with movies, and this was the studio. And one of the things they discovered among all the pieces there, they dug up these old wax cylinders, which were used first in the phonograph, they used wax cylinders first. And it turned out that this wax cylinder that they had had for years, when they finally got to digitalize this, they found the voice of Otto von Bismarck. And that is the only voice recording available of someone that was born in the 19th century. 18th century, sorry.
Right, 1700s.
18th century
yeah.
that we have. So people think that's fantastic, and it is.
Yeah.
But you know what? People don't realize we have the voice of God every day, right in front of us. And yet so often we ignore that. But it's historically backed, just like they knew that was Bismarck's voice because of the different historical things that they had. So we have God's voice. He's still speaking to us. Just like Bismarck is still speaking to us via wax cylinder.
Yes.
We have the voice of God right there in front of us. Never changes.
And at the end, towards the end of that chapter, you say, God has never been silent. All we have to do is listen.
That's right.
Now, I got to tell you, I have to tell you something, Penny. I am old enough to remember in the early 50s, my father had a dictaphone. He was a pastor, and he would practice his sermons, and they had these wax round cylinders, you know, instead of records or tape. So, you know.
Wow. You know how fragile they were.
I do.
And the fact that, that one survived all that time from Edison's time, from when they recorded Bismarck, is amazing.
Yeah, but I'm also telling you that you make me feel old. All right. Now,
No. You're not as old as Edison. I know you're not.
First and last, here's something called DeSoto National Monument. Revelation 22:13 says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Tell us about Hernando de DeSoto.
Hernando de Soto was a real stinker. Let's just put it that way.
I thought I remembered that.
He was a conquistador.
Yes.
You know, he came over from Spain. He helped Pizarro conquer Peru. And then he decided that he was back in Spain. He was bored, and so he wanted to come to La Florida to find all the wealth that was in the New World. Well, he never found that wealth, but he made everybody's life, including his own, miserable,
mm-hmm.
because he stole what he couldn't find. He enslaved the Native Americans, and he brought disease over into the population, which spread. And he finally died near the Mississippi River. He covered a lot of territory in southeast United States. And they buried him in the Mississippi River so that the Native Americans wouldn't find out that he wasn't immortal after all.
Uh-huh.
So he was the first in a lot of ways. He was the first to explore southeastern United States and first in many other ways. But he didn't last.
Yes.
But we have a savior who is the first and the last.
Mm.
Oh, hallelujah for that.
Well said. Yes, our first, our last, and our greatest hope is how it's put.
Yes.
Every day should be a Memorial Day. And you talk about Acadia National Park. And the quote is from Joshua chapter 4, verse 7. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. Now, first of all, where is Acadia National Park?
It's up in Maine.
Okay.
It's a beautiful, beautiful spot.
And what is it a memorial of?
Well, it's not so much a memorial, although the roads there were our courtesy of the Civilian Conservation Corps and John Rockefeller. He pumped a lot of money into there. But the problem at Acadia is that people steal the rocks, steal many of the rocks. And you know, when we take some of the rocks there, it's very rocky coastline. You know, we take things from places we've been as a memorial to remember the place. Oh, yeah, I remember when I was there from, you know, the stone reminds me of when I was there. So people are stealing them for remembrances.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, taking anything out of a national park is a federal offense.
Right.
But that, when I heard about that, when I read about that, and I had been to Acadia, but I read a news article about that, I thought, memorial, Joshua, stones. He had to set up a memorial. God told him to set up a memorial to remind the people of what God had done for them, finally bringing them into the promised land.
Uh-huh.
And we have to set up memorials for ourselves. We have to keep reminding ourselves again what God has done for us over and over again, not only for us, but for the generations to come, because they won't know unless we tell them what God has done for us and how his promises came true in our life.
Penny, when I talk to people who seem to have lost their faith at one point, they were close to the Lord, but for whatever reasons, I sometimes ask them to tell me about how they first came to the Lord. And by remembering how God had led them in the past, then their faith seems to be renewed. And
exactly.
It becomes quite a memorial thing. And also, when people are having some relationship problems, it's a good thing to think about why they first got together. Now, here's another one. My father came over from Germany in 1930, and the Depression was bad over there, but even though we had the Depression here, it was a lot better than in Germany.
Yeah.
And so you have a chapter called Strangers and Aliens, and you're talking about the Ellis Island. From Exodus 23, verse 9, it says, "Do not oppress an alien. You yourself know how it feels to be aliens because you are aliens in Egypt." As Americans, there's a lot of talk about immigrants and legal or illegal, but unless we're Native Americans, we're all immigrants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought about all the climate that is in the United States right now and really around the world. About all the immigration when I was writing that. And, you know, I said to my editor, is this going to be okay? You know, because I know among Christians there's a wide variety of thoughts about immigration and mm-hmm. all of that, and that's okay. And I don't really talk about what's right or not.
Right.
But the fact that we have to deal with immigration, and we also have to realize that we're all aliens and strangers in this world,
mm-hmm.
as being Christians.
Yes.
So therefore, we understand that. We, above all people, should understand that. And we also remember that our ancestors did come over, and
right.
they were strangers. I talk about my mother-in-law in that chapter, how she didn't know English because
yes.
her parents didn't know English, even though she was born in this country.
Right.
She was with fellow Sicilians and didn't speak the language.
Exactly.
And I hope someone recognized that this little girl needed our sympathy and our help. And, you know, it wasn't her fault that she didn't know English and stuff. And she eventually became a big success. She went on to, I mean, not big success, you know, not well-known, but, I mean, she went on to Hunter College. She had a career in the Army for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, she was a terrific mother to my husband.
Yes.
But we have to remember that we're all strangers and aliens on this earth.
That's right.
And remember that when we deal with other strangers
yes.
and aliens that are here.
Yes. Again, my father and his family, my father was 21 and they came over and really none of them spoke English. But of course, they came to New York and didn't have to, because you had the German sections and the Italian sections and the Jewish section, which spoke Yiddish, which is Hebrew and German together. And that's the way it went. And I'm not sure my grandparents ever really were comfortable with anything other than German. But my father, till I found a tape recorder of one of his sermons, and he still had this heavy, what I call a Henry Kissinger accent, you know, of thick German. But, you know, this is it. These were the way it was in the metro areas of Chicago and Detroit uh-huh. and New York and San Francisco especially. And so we think it's all new today, but it's not. It's the history of our country. But I remember as you were just talking, Penny, that there was a song I learned as a child. You know, this world is not my home. I'm just passing through. And that's really what it's about. Folks, if you've just tuned in, I'm talking with Penny Musco, and she's written a book called Life Lessons from the National Parks, Meeting God in America's Most Glorious Places. Now, tell us a little bit more. You have a chapter here on John Muir. Psalm 27:4 says, "One thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and seek him in his temple." How do you connect that with all that John Muir did for the National Park System?
John Muir was a Scottish immigrant who traveled extensively around the United States, and he finally ended up in Northern California, and he came to explore what is now Yosemite, the Yosemite Valley and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a quote in my book where he says, I'm out here and I haven't been in church for a while, but I feel like being here is like church.
Hmm.
This is where God resides. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we should stop going to church and,
right.
and, you know, just hang out in Yosemite and that's our church. But the idea of the beauty and the sacredness, he recognized that this is God embodied. And we see that in the beautiful scenery in our national parks and also the stories. But John Muir took the reins and he said, if we don't do something, these places are going to be commercialized.
Yeah.
This was back in the late 1900s,
mm-hmm.
1800s. Yeah, 1800s. He recognized that even then, you know, sheep back then it was sheep herders and,
right.
and ranchers and people cutting down trees. He recognized that this could go on if we didn't protect it.
Yeah.
And he was also a co-founder of the Sierra Club.
I see.
And so he recognized a lot about the environment, that we needed to set aside special places so everyone could enjoy them before they were wrecked.
Yeah.
And he's considered the father of the National Park Service because of that.
I've never been to Carlsbad Caverns, but my mother had. I think it was around 1940. And as a child, she would talk about visiting that, and at one point at that time, they would turn off the lights so that you could experience the total darkness. But you call this chapter Waiting on Hope, Carlsbad Caverns National Park. And Romans 5, starting with verse 2, says, "We rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. And perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God has poured out his love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, whom he has given us." Now, it was in the early 1900s, really, that more became known about Carlsbad Cavern. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Carlsbad was discovered by, they believe it was a teenage boy looking for guano, which mm-hmm. is bird droppings, which yeah. apparently that was pretty useful back then.
Yeah.
And he stumbled upon this, and he told other people, and gradually people began exploring this, and there's still parts of it they haven't uncovered yet, but it's an amazing place. And the way I tie it in with hope is that my husband and my mother, I was back at the hotel with my daughter, who didn't want to see the bats coming out of the cave because she was a teenager and, you know, that was like boring. So my mother and my husband stayed there to watch the bats come out. Apparently they come out at sunset and mm-hmm. it's an amazing sight. So they waited and nothing happened. My husband was really ticked off. But, you know, that's a small example of things that we hope for. There are so many big, big things that we hope for. But God covers all of them. You know, we're disappointed. We hope for so many things. We get a diagnosis that's bad. A child turns away from the Lord. The only thing we have to look for, sometimes is hope. And God offers that hope in every situation. And that's enough. That's enough.
Again, Penny Musco is the author of Life Lessons from the National Parks, Meeting God in America's Most Glorious Places. And I can certainly recommend this book, folks. Penny, where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
Well, you can get them through online, through Amazon or Barnes & Noble mm-hmm. or Books A Million. Or you can go to the brick-and-mortar Barnes & Noble stores and ask them to order you a copy.
Great. Penny, thanks for being with us today on LifeQuest.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. As you could tell, I love talking about the National Parks.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lanehoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.